Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Scope of Law Enforcement Proviso and Federal Tort Claims Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 19, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Millbrook v. United States. The question in this case is whether proviso in the Federal Tort Claims Act that permits suits against the federal government for assaults committed by law enforcement officers acting within the scope of their employment applies in a case where a federal prisoner was allegedly raped by prison guards. To discuss the case, we have Andrew Staropoulos, a professor of law and director of the Center for the Study of State Constitutional Law and Government at Oklahoma City University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Staropoulos.
On February 19th, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Millbrook v. United States of America. The case concerned whether federal prisoners may sue the government for intentional torts by prison guards. A federal inmate alleges that prison guards at a United States prison in Pennsylvania sexually assaulted and battered him. The Federal Tort Claims Act waives the government's sovereign immunity for claims arising out of several intentional torts, including assault and battery, but only if they're committed by federal investigative or law enforcement officers. The statute defines these officers as those who are empowered by law to execute searches, seize evidence, or make arrests. The court has to decide whether the statute intended to include prison guards who have the authority to take these actions, but did not do so in the particular case. What's especially interesting about this case is that the government won at every level below. The prisoner lost, the government won. But as the case came to the Supreme Court, the government changed its mind and now believes that it should have lost, that the statute was interpreted incorrectly by the lower courts, even though they ruled in favor of the government. So the government has switched sides, is on the same side as the prisoner, and the court had to appoint an amicus to argue for the government's case, which they did very well at the oral argument. It's a very interesting case because it is a classic contrast or classic conflict between interpreting the statute in the way that it appears to be written. The argument in favor of the prisoner is very strong when you read the text, but a series of knotty policy problems, really difficult issues in which you really question whether Congress actually intended for the statute to be written the way that it appears to be written, will ensue if they interpret the statute according to the text. The problem here is that the text seems to say relatively straightforwardly that any investigative or law enforcement officer who is empowered by law to execute searches, seize evidence, or to make arrests for violations of federal law is covered by the statute, is liable for these intentional torts. The government has conceded below, when it was winning, that prison guards are in fact covered by the statute. They are empowered by law to do these things. Now, they argued that because they weren't actually doing any of these things, so you're executing searches or seizing evidence or making arrests at the time, that the statute ought not to apply to them. What's interesting about the oral argument is that you would have thought that Justice Scalia would be the justice most likely to rule on the basis of the text, to say that the strong textual argument ought to prevail. But he actually was extremely skeptical about the prisoner's case, questioned their counsel as well as the government very aggressively, and said that, so suggested at least, that if you actually look at the structure of the statute, there are several torts that were omitted from the list of torts that these law enforcement officers are liable for, that from a previous section of the statute. And these torts did not have anything to do with actions such as assault and battery. They included things like libel, slander, misrepresentation, nonviolent torts. Scalia's suggestion was that these were omitted because they're not the kind of torts you'd commit while you're engaging in law enforcement activity. So his argument is that doesn't the statute then suggest, at least the structure of the statute, then say that the text really isn't as clear as the government and the prisoner seem to suggest, that in fact, if you understand the statute in its context, it clearly means that you're only liable for these torts if you're a law enforcement officer, if you're engaged in law enforcement activity, which these prison guards were not engaged at the time. They were not making arrests or seizing evidence. They were just simply trying to keep the prison orderly, which is not the same thing as engaging in these activities. The prisoner and the government tried to respond and said, no, the text is absolutely clear. There's no reason to look outside the text. There's no reason to look at the policy problems since the text is so clear. whereas against Scalia argued that the text really isn't as clear as people suggested. And the other judges, particularly Justice Kennedy, challenged the prisoner's counsel on all the policy problems that would be covered. For example, Bureau of Prisons employees, if they're all considered to be law enforcement officers, they'll be liable for all sorts of torts. They could be liable for a workplace assault, not just assault and batteries in prison. And also, the court seemed to be even more concerned that people with law enforcement authority who work for other agencies but really aren't law enforcement officers, well, they could possibly be liable too, even though they do things like meat inspections or OSHA inspections. The counsel for the government and for the prisoner had to say, no, that wouldn't be the case. The government in its brief tried to say, well, we should leave out officers who are engaged in actions of regulatory administrative nature as opposed to law enforcement because they were trying to mitigate the bad policy consequences that would ensue if this statute were interpreted literally. So we again have this classic clash between a literal interpretation of the statute and an interpretation of the statute in which Congress probably would argue did not intend for all these bad policy consequences to take place, that really all they intended when they expanded liability was just to apply this to actual law enforcement officers. And in fact, there's some evidence from the legislative history that that's what they were thinking about, that this statute was passed because there were abusive actions by people we would all consider to be law enforcement officers, in this case, narcotics agents, and that what Congress really intended was not for the statute, despite the way that it was written, to apply as broadly as it appears to. Always impossible, of course, to tell from the oral argument which way the court's going to go, but if you look at the oral argument, certainly the government and the prisoner were given a much harder time than the counsel, the amicus, who's representing the government's position, or at least the government's original position.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.